I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit, an online service that allows users to outsource small tasks to individuals known as TaskRabbits. These TaskRabbits are freelance workers who have been background checked, and they perform small jobs ranging from grocery shopping to furniture assembly. Leah started the company in 2008, and the service is available in major cities, including Boston, Seattle, and San Francisco. Leah is a software engineer who formerly worked at IBM. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Jessica.
Before we get started on the history of the company, I'd love to know in more detail how TaskRabbit works. Let's say I need my computer repaired.
So it's really simple. Anyone can go online or pick up their iPhone and use their iPhone app, Android as well, and you post that you need help with some computer repair. You can either name the price you're willing to pay, or you can put that job out to bid. At that time, the TaskRabbits in our network are real-time alerted, typically via their mobile phones as well. They log on to the site and get connected and help you out.
The ages of these TaskRabbits range from, 20 years old to close to 80 years old. What's an example of an older TaskRabbit?
It's funny. When I started TaskRabbit back in Boston, I thought, Boston's a great college town. I'm going to get all these students that want to become TaskRabbits running around the city. And that actually was never the case. As an example, over 25% of our TaskRabbit community is part of the retired workforce. I personally had a TaskRabbit named Margaret out of San Francisco pick me up at 2 in the morning from a U2 concert that was in Oakland and drive me back home because I didn't have a car out there and I had gone out with some friends and couldn't get back to San Mateo. And it was funny because I was chatting with her on the way home, 2 in the morning, and she said, I don't sleep well, I'm really a night owl, and so being able to pick up jobs like this is perfect for me.
Can you provide some more examples of tasks? You mentioned the U2 concert, this woman picking you up. But what is a spectrum of tasks that you've experienced?
There's a wide variety of tasks that are posted, but by far the most popular for us are around deliveries. Things like grocery delivery, food delivery, picking up packages, courier-type services around town have been hugely popular. The other thing for our small and medium-sized business customers, it's our fastest-growing segment right now. They're utilizing TaskRabbit to find assistants and office managers.
What about on the more personal front?
So one of my favorite stories has to do with a mother located in San Francisco who has a 20-year-old son living in Boston. And unfortunately, her son was going through chemotherapy treatment at Mass General Hospital, and she couldn't fly out there to be with him at the time. So she went on the TaskRabbit website, posted a task to find someone in Boston to go visit her son every day in the hospital for a week, to bring him a healthy meal and a cozy blanket, and to sit with him for 30 minutes every single day, and then call her afterwards to give her the update. And the TaskRabbit that picked up the job in Boston was actually another mom. So the bond that these two moms formed across the country was just incredible and really proves that what we've built goes far beyond just task jobs and errands. It's really redefining who your neighbors are and who you can rely on.
Even though many of the jobs take place in one's neighborhood, they can be done virtually or from one city to another.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I've used it once. My husband and I were looking for an older dog, and we posted the task on TaskRabbit, and we ended up working with this lawyer who was in between jobs.
Particularly, in the early days, I was surprised by the folks that were in between work. I had lawyers, I had pharmacists, I had teachers that were coming to the TaskRabbit platform. And that actually has held true even as the economy has improved.
Could you provide some more examples of even, quirky tasks that you've seen?
People get really creative. We had someone post that they wanted help pranking their office mate. So they had the TaskRabbit wrap this person's desk and chairs and pens and pencils, everything in cellophane.
Where was that? What city?
This was in Boston. There's another one more recently in San Francisco where I don't know why, but this person had one of those rubber chickens that sort of hang, and they wanted a tuxedo made
for the
rubber chicken.
You do background checks on your freelance workers who become your TaskRabbits, and you place their photo on the site so users can choose based on many criteria, including, you know, maybe does this person look friendly and does this person look trustworthy? How important do you think the photos were in those choices?
Incredibly important. I mean, people look at these profiles and they think, would I want to let this person into my grandmother's house? And we hear that over and over again. And so it does make a huge difference. And we're even now allowing TaskRabbits to upload introductory videos about themselves to their profiles just to make it more interactive and more engaging. And it just helps with that trust level.
How much do you monitor the tasks that are posted? You know, some people might post illicit tasks.
So a couple of things. One is that we're a self-policing community, meaning anyone can flag a task as inappropriate, and that happens sometimes. We recently saw a task get flagged as inappropriate because someone had posted they wanted a TaskRabbit to complete their online driving school. You know, and the other thing that provides a barrier for people is that we do ask for credit card information up front. We don't charge for your task until it's actually completed and done. But it does provide a little bit of a barrier for people that are just looking to kind of spam the site or get away with something that's more fraudulent.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit, a website and mobile app that allows users to outsource small tasks to individuals known as TaskRabbits. Prior to launching TaskRabbit, you were a software engineer at IBM, and your interest in computer science stems back to high school, where your boyfriend introduced you to computers, your boyfriend, now your husband, Kevin Buskey. Can you describe your first exposure with him to computers?
So Kevin and I are high school sweethearts. We started dating in high school. We went to both junior and senior prom together. But we would spend Friday nights at his house building computers. We would go to computer shows on the weekends and pick out motherboards and bus systems and then spend a Friday night, you know, putting them together. And so I immediately became fascinated with what was involved in doing that. And that really influenced me later as I went on to college and sort of inspired me to take some computer courses.
What was your first computer in your house?
It was a Gateway. I think it was Gateway 2000 or 3000, one of those. But Kevin was the one that actually went with my family to the Gateway store and helped us pick out our first computer.
I heard somewhere that Kevin built a computer for you. Is that accurate?
He did, yes. The computer I lugged with me to Sweetbriar College in Virginia is the computer he built for me. And we picked out the parts together. He put it together for me, and that was the computer I used all through college.
You grew up in Massachusetts, about an hour west of Boston, and you attended the local high school together. Why did you decide to go to rural Virginia, Sweetbriar College?
Great question. You know, it's the only school that I applied to outside of New England. It was the only women's college I applied to. I never thought I would end up there. But my mom and I, we took a road trip one weekend for accepted applicants weekend, and we drove down to Virginia. We drove onto the Sweetbriar campus, and I just immediately fell in love with it. And it was a small school, 600 students. The student-teacher ratio was something like 7 to 1. So you couldn't hide there.
How many other women were computer science and math majors? Because you were a dual major.
I was a dual major in math and computer science, and it was a small program. I think in my graduating class, there may be 5 of us that were in that math and or computer science program.
Was there one or two pivotal projects that you worked on that really helped you sink your teeth into software engineering that you can remember?
Yeah, there was definitely this one project. It was for an operating systems class. And what we built was this little robot that you could move around the screen using the keyboard. The fact that I could code something in this language, this computer language, and I could translate that into a product that people could interact with was really exciting. And it was just this this JPEG of a robot moving around the screen based on keyboard strokes. But I ran back to my dorm room, and I showed my roommates what I had built, this little robot. They thought I was crazy, but I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And for me, that project was just the start of, I have all these ideas in my head and things that I want to build, and I can do that.
Incidentally, going back to your childhood, what did your parents do?
My father recently retired from the Air Force. He was a civilian in the Air Force for over 30 years, and he worked at Hanscom Air Force Base. One division that he was in for a long time, the Electronic Systems Center, dealt with all the training programs across Hanscom Air Force Base.
You had an interest and have an interest in space. Is that somewhat linked to this Air Force?
I think so. It absolutely came from my dad. And I remember ever since I was a little girl, I've always wanted to become an astronaut. And still to this day, I would love to go to space. You know, my dad had a big influence on both my sister and I, and we were really into science fiction. We watched all the Star Treks together every night. And so it's just something that has always fascinated me.
You also were very serious about dance growing up. You thought at one point you might want to be a classical ballerina.
That's true. And in fact, I chose the college I went to based on their dance program, primarily. A lot of my friends went on to dance in professional ballet companies, and something that has always been a part of my life.
After graduating from college, you worked at a startup in Boston called Iris Associates. And Kevin, your then boyfriend, was also in Boston. He was also working in computer programming. Iris ultimately developed Lotus Notes, and the company Iris was sold to Lotus. Can you remind people or explain to people what Lotus Notes did?
Lotus Notes is kind of like Microsoft Outlook. Hundreds of thousands of people around the globe still run on Lotus Notes and Domino. It's an incredibly stable and robust collaboration platform.
And IBM ultimately acquired Iris, or Lotus.
That's true, yes. Lotus bought Iris, and then IBM bought Lotus, and we sort of all got merged into IBM.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit. We'll hear more from Leah coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit, an online service that allows users to outsource small tasks to individuals known as TaskRabbits. Leah started the company in 2008, and the service is available in major cities, including Boston, Seattle, and San Francisco. Leah is a software engineer who formerly worked at IBM. I've heard you mention that you felt a lot of pressure to write very solid code when you were at Iris or at IBM that was free of bugs, because you would introduce products really on a 2-year interval. How much did that inform your programming going forward?
Yeah, it was a huge influence. You know, when you're on an 18 to 24-month software life cycle and the code that you check in that day isn't going to be actually seen by customers for a couple years, you really have to make sure that it's solid. Because at the time, you know, we're packaging up CDs, boxing them, and mailing them around the globe. There's no quick fixes. There's no quick patches that you can send out if you've really broken something. And so the culture at Iris was very hardcore into quality. And every morning, I remember there was this big build room. If you checked in code that broke the build for the day, it was not a good thing. It was really embarrassing. You'd have to go down to the build room. You'd have to put a dollar in the jar. And you'd have to sit there and debug it with the release engineers. And so it was a big deal. Nowadays, everything has changed. We at TaskRabbit push code every day, if not multiple times a day. but we definitely have been influenced by the high quality and high standards that is just in our DNA.
So going back to IBM, how much were you itching to start your own project while you were at IBM?
You know, in the early days that I was there, I was incredibly happy and saw a long career for myself there. I spent 7 years there as a programmer, and I'd say the last couple years I started to kind of pick my head up and look around and think about what else might be out there. So I remember at IBM every year we had this conference called Lotusphere, and it was the one time a year that they let the developers and the engineers go out and talk to customers. And I loved interacting with the customers. And for me, that was the most fun part of my job. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I wanted to find something where I could have more interaction externally.
Now, your husband was also at IBM for a while before he left to work at a couple startups in Boston. Did you just both end up at IBM coincidentally?
Well, his father also works at IBM. Mm-hmm. And so when we graduated from college, me with a computer science degree, Kevin had actually been working as an intern there throughout the whole time. And so his father was able to kind of get me in the door too, and the three of us were there. And then we also met Brian Leonard, who is our lead architect at TaskRabbit, when he was at IBM.
How ultimately did you decide on TaskRabbit?
You know, we had the idea for TaskRabbit one night, my husband and I, when we were sitting at home, we're getting ready to go out to dinner, and we realized that we were out of dog food. And at the time, we had this 100-pound yellow lab named Kobe that we kept very well fed. And we thought, wouldn't it be nice if there was just a place online we could go, say we needed dog food, name the price we're willing to pay. We were certain that there was someone in our neighborhood that'd be willing to help us out. Maybe even someone at the store at that very second. It was just a matter of connecting with them. 4 months after that night is when I decided to quit IBM to build the first version of the site. And I thought, I know how to build this. I don't know what comes after that, but I'm just going to go build it and see what happens.
Incidentally, when you came up with the idea that night, you quickly acquired the URL runmyerrand.com, which was the precursor name.
That is true. And so we took that as a sign, actually, the fact that domain names are never available these days. That was the first domain name I looked up, and it was available, and I bought it on the spot. But 20 minutes later, I hated it, and I knew that I would have to change the name at some point, and we did about 18 months later.
Now, you had been at IBM in the stable job where Kevin had gone on to work at a few startups, and you were the breadwinner for a couple of years. How did you decide to switch now that you had left and to start this company?
Yeah, it was a very intense and stressful time, to be honest. We decided that we had about, you know, 6 months in the bank. I cashed out my pension from IBM and used that to fund the initial stages of the company. And so we sort of started the clock. And that was in June of 2008. And we said, you know what, by the end of the year, something has to happen. 6 months went by, and I was really close to being able to raise a seed round of funding, but this was the end of 2008 when no one was raising money, no one was writing checks, the stock market had just crashed. It was very stressful. But 3 months later, it took 9 months total, I was able to raise a small seed from two angel investors in Boston that really allowed us to keep going.
How were you introduced to them, given that you had no interaction with the venture community prior?
So the way I was introduced to Peter Aldrich and Jill Priotto, they were the two that led a small seed round of investment, $150,000. So Scott Griffith was the one who introduced me to Jill and Peter. Scott, at the time, was the CEO of Zipcar. He and I met through a friend of a friend of a friend, told him about TaskRabbit over a 30-minute meeting in his office, and we just really hit it off. Mm-hmm. He came on as an advisor and as a mentor to me, even incubated me and TaskRabbit in his office for the first year that we existed for free.
At Zipcar.
At Zipcar, yeah.
Zipcar, by the way, is the car sharing service where you're in any city, you could rent a Zipcar and drop it off at another location where you end up. Basically.
Exactly, yeah. And so Scott really kind of took me under his wing and helped me learn about how to pitch investors and how to raise money and what I needed to do. And he introduced me to Jill and Peter. And then later that year, I raised the larger seed round, $1.8 million that came from Silicon Valley seed investors.
What exactly were you building? Were you building the website?
I was. So I left IBM in June. Basically locked myself in my house for 10 weeks straight, and all I did was code, and got the first version of TaskRabbit, at the time Run My Errand, launched in Boston in September of 2008. I had about 100 users, I had about 30 TaskRabbits, and they were interacting on the platform.
Were most of these people your friends, or how did you cultivate interest?
Yeah, I remember the very first task that was posted by someone I didn't know was very exciting, and it was to return a tuxedo that they had rented for a wedding. They paid one of my founding TaskRabbits in Boston $10 to do it, and it went off without a hitch. So that was a neat moment for me to think about. Early on, we launched in just one neighborhood of Boston, Charlestown. And that's where I really focused my marketing efforts and the word of mouth efforts, and launched specifically with the Charlestown Mothers Organization, who I had interacted with and who were really excited about trying the service out.
Was there a catalyst for you that caused the floodgates to open in terms of user adoption? What was it?
You know, once I really engaged with the Charlestown Mothers Association, which was 600 moms in one square mile of Boston. But those moms started talking to the moms in Beacon Hill and Back Bay and Cambridge, and it started just to spread very organically via word of mouth. Then I was frantic to recruit more TaskRabbits all over the city, and it really snowballed from there.
Was your programming as solid as your Iris IBM days had trained you to be?
You know, I had never coded in Ruby on Rails before. I never coded for the web before.
What's Ruby on Rails?
Ruby on Rails is the programming language that TaskRabbit is built on. I had always coded in C++ and Java at IBM. And so this was a completely new programming language I had to learn. And so there was definitely a lot of trial and error there. And it's funny because 18 months after I built the first version of the site, we ended up throwing away all of my code. And just even a couple months ago, we erased the last line of code that I had originally built. And so, you know, those initial iterations were not scalable, but they worked. They got the product out there and they got people using it.
There weren't major crashes in the early days or?
No, I mean, I think that's a testament to just my training. That site never went down.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit, a website and mobile app that allows users to outsource small tasks to individuals known as TaskRabbits. You've raised over $40 million in venture financing at this point. How much does that help you feel legitimized? What do you have to say about that?
You know, the first 2 to 3 years that we existed, we had no money. We were bootstrapped. We were dying to get our A round done, dying to get $5 million in the bank. And after we got that A round done, the B round, the C round, all those things came very easily. And so for me, I still operate like we have no money. And I think mentally that's a good thing. But it's because I've seen the market be so low and for it to be so hard to raise funds. When I had the opportunity to take on more funds, I took it, even though we didn't necessarily need it. Because I've seen how hard it can be, and I want to have the staying power that we're going to need to build a huge business that we have in front of us.
And this was after you did this Facebook incubator, where you were part of the first Facebook incubator class. I don't know if many people know that Facebook has an incubator. What was that experience like for you?
I think back on it, and it was like a startup boot camp. We were one of 25 companies invited to participate. The majority of the other companies were from the Bay Area already. We were the only ones from the East Coast that were kind of flying back and forth to participate. And at the time, Facebook Connect had just come out, was just launched. And so Facebook saw this as a way to engage with companies that were building interesting things on top of the social graph, on top of their platform, and how they could cultivate and encourage that.
And how much did that experience sort of actualize this concept for you? You were serious about it from the get-go, so perhaps you didn't need it to actually corroborate what you were doing.
You know what it did, though? It really opened up my eyes and the networking that was available in Silicon Valley for me, because I was from the East Coast. I had never even set foot in California before I did the Facebook Fund program. And so I remember landing for the first time in San Francisco, and I was kind of like, okay, here we go. I don't know what is in store for me.
Was there any discussion about Kevin potentially joining you and becoming a co-founder of TaskRabbit, your husband?
Yeah, so at the time, we were really bootstrapping our lives. Kevin was the big breadwinner, and we had a mortgage, and we ended up selling the house in Boston so that we could move to San Francisco. And so it wasn't until the company got a little bit bigger and we needed someone full-time to run the servers and do the infrastructure, which is what Kevin's an expert at, that he came on board.
There are several companies in this space, ranging from Skill Pages, which connects skilled workers with those who want to hire them, to Fiverr, where you pay somebody $5 to get you a latte, to companies that are helping business owners. How do you see this landscape evolving?
So I think it's a pretty exciting time, because 5 years ago, the technology did not exist to do what we're doing today. And that's why we're seeing all of these other companies pop up. The fact that we can leverage social networking, and we have real-time location data on mobile, and people walk around 24/7 with their smartphones, are all reasons why we're able to connect in real time to exchange services and to get things done. For TaskRabbit, our vision is to revolutionize the labor force on a global scale.
So what does that really mean?
It means that we're redefining how people think about work, how they find work. We really want to empower people to do what they love. We have people on the platform that are chefs, that are carpenters, that are handymen. We have people that have left their full-time jobs and are now doing TaskRabbit full-time.
What's the most that somebody has made on TaskRabbit?
We had a TaskRabbit just last month, actually, cash out $10,000 that they had made that month. They were doing 2 to 3 jobs a day. They have a big truck for hauling, which is something pretty unique in an urban environment. So their services were needed across the city quite frequently.
It's been said that you coined this term service networking, which essentially is using the internet to get off the internet. What is service networking?
So the idea of service networking really, for me, came out of the evolution of social networking.
Which is?
So Facebook has become very popular, Twitter as well, and it's really about creating online interactions in a social way. With everyone has, 5,000 friends now online, and they probably haven't met, 2/3 of them. But for me, service networking was really about utilizing technology to make real connections in the real world to help real people get real things done. I think that that's exactly what we've built with TaskRabbit. The fact that you can go on TaskRabbit, you can see who's in your neighborhood, you can look at their profiles, their ratings, their reviews, their reputation. You can understand why you would trust that person to deliver your groceries or to hang a picture on your wall is something that you didn't have access to as far as information goes before.
So some might think it ironic that an online service actually brings you closer to knowing your neighbors than you might have otherwise.
A decade ago, there was probably a kid in your neighborhood who you could have wash your car or mow your lawn. But I actually think with the age of the internet ended up siloing us a bit. It made things anonymous. It made things untransparent. And so we're bringing that transparency back. We're bringing that identity back to the internet in a way that allows people to trust each other again.
Dance and computer science seem pretty disparate from each other, but do you see any connective tissue between the two?
I do. I think particularly with ballet, the movement is so specific and so precise. And with computer science, with mathematics, with programming, it's the preciseness and the discipline around that that makes great programs. All of these things, math and computer science and dance, have all made me into the entrepreneur I am today. And it's definitely this sense of discipline that I have around everything that I do that I think has helped get us this far.
I've heard you say before that you've always been obsessed with efficiency mm-hmm. also. And TaskRabbit, the goal of TaskRabbit is improving efficiency in one's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also true. I mean, I remember when I was at Sweetbriar, my friends would make fun of me because I'd always take a very specific route to my classes. And it was always the straightest route because I would say, well, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. But I think that efficiency just has always been a part of my life, has always driven how I think about things, even mundane things about, you know, how I'm going to walk to my next class or where I'm going to walk to get lunch. And so that efficiency piece, I think, is a big part of TaskRabbit's DNA as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Leah Buskey, founder of TaskRabbit.
Coming up, we'll hear from Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a cupcake franchise in the Middle East. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. Fadi opened the first Sugar Daddies in Amman, Jordan in 2007 when he was 30, and there are now Sugar Daddies franchises in Dubai and Beirut, Lebanon. Fadi grew up in Saudi Arabia and went to high school and college in the United States, and he is the son of Palestinian refugees. Fadi worked in marketing at Unilever prior to becoming a cupcake entrepreneur. Welcome, Fadi.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks.
When did you first discover American cupcakes?
When I was a kid growing up on this American compound that was run by an oil company in Saudi Arabia. A lot of my classmates, actually the majority of them, were Americans. And whenever they'd have me over for birthday parties or just dinners, their mothers always baked these wicked cupcakes or brownies or cookies, and I just fell in love with American desserts.
What is an American compound? Can you describe that a little bit?
It's basically this huge city within walls, and it has about 40,000, maybe 50,000 residents. So it's very self-sufficient. We've got our own school. We have our own commissary / supermarket, mail center, like almost our own government within this compound.
And you said it was the compound of an oil company. What oil company was it?
Aramco. So basically all the kids I went to school with, their parents worked for this oil company. They could be engineers or doctors. My father personally was a doctor. So because there were so many residents that there needed to be a hospital to cater to service the residents. And that's where my father worked.
And then you were educated in the United States for high school. Where did you go to college?
I went to Lehman Mary in Virginia.
What did you do after graduating from college?
Fresh out of graduation from college, I went back to Saudi Arabia where my parents were wrapping up their career at Aramco and heading towards retirement. But I got accepted to Unilever, and their main office was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, which is on the western side.
Did you enjoy working at Unilever? What did you do for them?
I did. I really liked it. I worked in their marketing department, which is what I majored in college. Initially, when I first joined Unilever, I was helping the brand manager on skincare products, such as Vaseline and Pond's, and the skin lightening cream called Fair and Lovely. And then I moved on to become a brand manager on Close-Up Toothpaste.
So how did you shift from marketing Vaseline and Close-Up Toothpaste to running a cupcake franchise? What was the turning point?
I just knew that at some point I wanted to get out of the corporate world and do something on my own. And I went to New York on holiday. I think it was 4 years into my career at Unilever. And my friend was dying to take me to Magnolia's. And so she took me there. I fell in love with the concept. And I thought, hey, this would be a great business opportunity for the Middle East.
Magnolia Bakery, the cupcake store in the West Village, which became famous through Sex and the City, the TV episode.
Exactly.
Do you remember which specific cupcake it was that you ate?
It was the vanilla with pink frosting, which apparently is their bestseller.
And so at that moment, you sort of said, aha, I'm going to open up a cupcake shop in the Middle East. Did you think you would open up one shop? And how did you know you wanted it to be in Jordan?
Well, my parents had retired in Jordan in 2000, soon after I joined, or pretty much at the same time that I joined Unilever. And I helped my parents design their home, their retirement home. So naturally, I developed a strong emotional attachment to our house, which was in Jordan. And I told my parents one day, I want to come back and live here with you guys. I had been away from home since I was 15, and I just felt it was time to return to the nest. And my dad said, as soon as you have a business idea, let me know, and I'll be the first to back you up.
When you decided to leave your job and, you know, pursue this path of opening a bakery, when did you go to your boss and say, I'm leaving Unilever?
After I had lunch with my friend at Subway, and he told me, you know, it's now or never. I basically sat with him, and I was like, I had just come out of a really terrible meeting at work, and I was just fed up, and I was like, I really just want to be my own boss and do my own thing, and I really want to open this cupcake shop.
Mm.
He's like, well, do it. And I'm like, yeah, but I need to stick around at Unilever for a few more years and save up more money and, you know, make sure I have enough capital. And he was like, well, have you done your homework? Do you know how much money you're going to need to start up a cupcake shop in Jordan?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, not really. I was like, but I do know I need to go to culinary school first. So I did my homework. I spent a few days researching, and I found this great culinary school in New York City. And so I applied. I got accepted. And then I went straight to my boss's office and resigned.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that resignation meeting.
It was a really nice memory because I had a really good rapport with everybody I worked with at Unilever. I was very friendly with everyone, and they were with me. And I remember telling my boss's boss that I was leaving to pursue this dream of mine. And he was like, I tip my hat to you. Well done. You know, most people spend their whole life trying to figure out what it is they want to do, and you figured it out at the age of 28. And he didn't object. He supported me, and everybody else in the company did the same. And a lot of them were very envious and jealous because they were, you know, had families and wives and children, and whose wives would divorce them if they left this, like, you know, steady, high-paying job to open a cupcake shop. So since I had no responsibilities, I could afford to do something like that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. Fadi opened the first Sugar Daddies in Amman, Jordan in 2007, and there are now Sugar Daddies franchises in Dubai and Beirut, Lebanon. So you quit your job at Unilever and you become a student at the Institute for Culinary Education in New York City. Was it the first time that you were going to be living in New York?
Yes, and that was another huge impetus for me to go to culinary school in New York, is I had fallen in love with the city over the years after I graduated from college, actually, because I had kept visiting one of my best friends that lives there. I loved the energy in the air. I loved the architecture. I loved the free spirit, I don't know, there was just so many appealing things about New York, and I was like, one day I want to live here, even if for just a year.
And when you finished the Institute for Culinary Education, were you enthusiastic about
rushing back to Amman, Jordan to open up this cafe?
I'll have to admit, I cried the entire way to JFK Airport as I said goodbye to my beautiful brownstone apartment with exposed brick in the bedroom. So I did. I literally sat in the cab and I cried, and the cab driver thought I was off my rockers.
You do sound enamored with American culture, or at least New York culture, to some extent. And, you know, in a way, that's translated to cupcakes.
Exactly.
And how do you think locals in Jordan react to the American influence?
It has been nothing but positive, to be honest with you. It's a really good question you ask. Because, yes, there is maybe slight resentment towards the U.S. foreign policy, but not necessarily to the American culture and the American people and American products.
The price per cupcake is, you know, quite expensive for a Jordanian whose annual, you know, income is, let's say, $5,000 on average. So we're talking about a clientele that perhaps is the upper echelon of Jordanian society to some extent.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not catering to the masses of Jordanians. Obviously, the ones, you know, that are making the kind of income that you're talking about would have never heard of a cupcake. Completely alien to them, and they would not be ready to spend as much money on a piece of cake as the types of consumer that I'm targeting.
Have you thought about making a cupcake or starting a shop that is more economical, that so that more people in Jordan could benefit?
It would be very difficult because we pride ourselves on the quality of our cupcakes, and we use really expensive ingredients and imported flour and you know, really high quality chocolate. And so it would be very difficult for me to price it any lower than I already have in order to make it affordable without compromising on quality. So not really.
Have you injected any Middle Eastern spin into the products? We talk about how much your clients like the American culture and they appreciate just a pure American cupcake, but have you injected any Middle Eastern spin into some of the cupcakes?
I have. One of our other really popular cakes is our date cake. So dates is a huge integral ingredient in a lot of our foods, and it's very popular during Ramadan, which is the holy month of fasting that Muslims observe. You break your fast on a date. So I've incorporated dates into some of my recipes, and they're quite popular, actually.
Is that called the Ramadan cupcake?
Yes, we call it that. Well, it was called the Ramadan cupcake when I first marketed it, but now we've got clever names for all of our cupcakes, so we've named it the Blind Date.
What are some other names of your cakes? Cupcakes.
Our carrot cupcake is called the 24 Carat. The banana cupcake is called Monkey Business. Mm-hmm. The strawberry cupcake is called Pink Cadillac. And the vanilla is called the Fake Blonde.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. So you started your first shop in 2007 in Amman. How did you get the word out that you were starting a cupcake shop?
Well, in the year that my shop took to complete construction, I couldn't sit around and do nothing. So I started baking from my house. I printed out my menu, and I circulated it in all the hair salons that I knew my target market would be frequenting, or the nail salons, or the gyms. And ladies started calling me and placing orders. And it was just complete word of mouth. So I had, you know, my name out even before I even opened my shop.
What was harder for you than you thought it would be?
I think the construction of the shop was a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. The first time doing it was definitely one of the most difficult, challenging experiences in my life. It took me an entire year to finish an 80 square meter shop space, which is roughly about 900 square feet. That's ridiculous. It shouldn't take more than 2 months.
Why did it take so long?
Just all sorts of complications. I relied on my architect to be my contractor, which is one mistake. You never do that. In fact, it's illegal in most countries to employ your architect as a contractor. You need to have both positions be completely separate.
You mentioned that you cried all the way to JFK when you were leaving New York to go back to Amman, to Jordan, to start this company. When you were constructing your store before you got it off the ground, Did you have any moments where you were wishing you were somewhere else or not pursuing this?
You know what? No. Despite the anxiety and the stress, there was not one second where I wished to be doing something else. So I just stuck with it. I cried a lot and screamed and fought with everybody and yelled and, you know, lost a lot of hair on my head and just like, but I just kept with it.
Aside from the construction challenges, what were some of the other issues you faced in the early days?
Well, I remember, for example, having recruited kitchen staff. And I went to the local culinary school, which wasn't really a culinary school. It's more of a hospitality school. But they do give them some kitchen coursework. So I recruited, I think, four guys from there to work in our kitchen. And months into having recruited them, and they kept calling me to try to find out the progress on the construction. And I kept saying, one more month. And they eventually got so fed up. But I think they found other jobs. But they didn't have the courage to tell me that. So when I finally was ready to train and we had a shop and it was completed and it was ready to go, I called the four guys and I just told them that we were going to start training at 8 in the morning the following day. And so they said, okay, we'll be there. And none of them showed up. So on the first day of training, and we were about 3 days away from the grand opening, I had no staff in the kitchen. So I panicked, and I looked at my four baristas that had showed up to training, and I asked them, do you guys know of anybody that could come work for us? And they all whipped out their cell phones, made a few phone calls, and within 24 hours, I had four kitchen staff, new ones, that my baristas had recommended, and they are the same guys that are with me till this day.
You weren't just starting a business, but you were starting a business with ingredients that your employees never were exposed to before, or even with products that your employees had never been exposed to before. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, the one incident that sticks out in my head the most is when we first opened, you know, my staff had never been exposed to any of the desserts that we were making. So they had no idea what a cupcake was or what a brownie was, and I was teaching them stuff from scratch. So they didn't know that there was light brown sugar and dark brown sugar. They never knew what molasses was that we use in ginger snap cookies. They didn't even know what a ginger snap cookie was. And I remember telling them about the carrot cake, and I had mentioned on the task list to make carrot cake pineapple. So they just, it's like crushed pineapple in the actual cake batter. So I overheard one of the guys telling the other baker, just put crushed pineapple, don't put any carrots. And I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, you said here with pineapple. And I'm like, how can it be called a carrot cake if it doesn't have any carrot inside of it? He literally just thought that you could make a carrot cake just using the crushed pineapple and you didn't need to put any shredded carrots in there. And I was just, wow, astounded. Like, this is going to be a long journey. But now my guys are better bakers than I am.
You mentioned that you had guys who were going to work for you. How come no women?
It's difficult to recruit women to work back of the house, you know, doing laborious, like, kitchen work. You mostly find women working in professional jobs here in the Middle East. Or especially in Jordan, but you rarely find like a waitress or a dishwasher or a cook. You know, they're mostly guys.
I wonder, just as you pioneered, you know, cupcakes and American baked goods in the Middle East or in Amman, Jordan, at least, if you could also pioneer having a couple of women working for you in the kitchen. What a novel concept.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly. I've had girls approach me to want to work in my bakery, but it's like, I can't, you know, they're girls from, like, you know, they speak perfect English and went to school in the States and whatnot, and I'm just thinking in my head, like, do you want to work in my bakery so you can get all my secrets and then open a cupcake shop yourself in Jordan and compete with me? So there's always that threat as well.
Who funded the business?
The first shop was funded in thirds by me, by my father, my brother, and I.
What did it cost to get the whole shop up and running?
Excluding culinary school?
Excluding culinary school.
$180,000.
And including culinary school, how much is culinary school?
Culinary school plus living in New York cost me $50,000. And I paid for that personally from my savings.
So in a way, you've led somewhat of an insulated life. You grew up on this American compound in Saudi Arabia. You went to an American boarding school. You went to college in Virginia. How is it, you know, being back in Amman, Jordan, where you are not insulated anymore? Have you thought about that difference?
It's a little bit difficult, to be honest with you. But I've managed to adjust. And I think what makes it easier is that I have a loving family, and I just have a really comfortable setup in general. But it's difficult, given my upbringing, to live in as traditional and conservative of a society as Jordan is. Now, it's not obviously nowhere near as conservative as Saudi Arabia is, but still, it's different for me.
And how involved are you in the business now?
I'm very involved. I still, if I'm in the shop and happy birthday needs to be written on a cake, I still do that because my guys prefer my handwriting over theirs. I do the accounting on a daily basis myself, so I know every penny that's been spent and every penny that has been generated. And I still assign the task on a daily basis to my staff.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.